Would you believe that I actually met Bertrand Russell? Now, this was more than half a century ago, and I was very, very young, and he was already very, very old, but I was in awe of him because, well, apart from his extraordinary range of activities, we'd come to exactly the same conclusions about religion. Bertrand Russell, a giant of 20th century thought, and like the Greek philosophers, he spanned across so many disciplines. His work had a great influence on philosophy, maths, logic, computer science, cognitive science, and, yes, left-wing politics. He was awarded a Nobel for his work on human rights and freedom of thought, and it's one of his lesser-known areas that we will be discussing tonight in a short essay with the wonderful title In Praise of Idleness, which my next guest argues is a must-read for us all. Bradley Trevor Grieve, hereinafter known as BTG, rose to stratospheric prominence back in 2000 with the publication of the Blue Day Book. It was a small book designed to, quote, lift the spirits of anyone who has got the blues. So it's not surprising that you or someone you know is mathematically certain to own a copy. It was stationed at the front counter of every bookshop in Australia for years. I hated him. I hated him. He wrote many more books, selling a staggering cop. There's 25 million of them worldwide. And now he's written a funny and beautifully illustrated introduction to Bert Russell's essay and indeed his life. BTG, welcome to LNL.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. It's been, I think, 19 years since you invited me to your home in Sydney after plucking me from obscurity to include my cartoons in the Contemporary Australian Humour and Satire published by Penguin.
Good God, I'd forgotten that, but I haven't forgotten meeting Bert. Isn't that interesting? I forget everything that happened. You know, my short-term memory is entirely evaporated, but I do remember the distant past.
Well, you were very generous, and of course you therefore have to take responsibility, as you do with Barry McKenzie, for having unleashed us upon the world.
I like to think that Barry McKenzie and Bertrand Russell are thus affiliated. Now, first of all, would you be kind enough to remind the dear listener who Bertrand Russell actually was? Give us some of his greatest hits.
Oh, of course. Well, it's an embarrassment of choice. Published thousands of articles and some 70 published works, and I think we have 40,000 at least collected letters in the archives at McMaster University in Canada, where I started my book. But he is arguably the greatest philosopher and logician of the 20th century. Some would argue that title with his protege, or sometime protege, Wittgenstein, but I like to think of Russell as the great luminous intellectual force, and Wittgenstein as the fractured diamond that gleamed so brightly so infrequently. He was the son of, or the grandson of, the great John Russell, who granted Australia Federation and was a great liberal figure, best mates with Napoleon. But of course, Russell came to be known as the prominent philosopher of his age. I think by the time the First World War came around, he was indisputably the most celebrated philosopher in the Western world. And then he became the most celebrated philosopher in the entire world after his visits to Russia and China in 1920 and 1921. He did win the Nobel Prize, but it was not for the Peace Prize, as you said earlier. It was actually for literature. And the work that he was nominated for in particular was his History of Philosophy, which still, I would argue, is one of the most accessible and interesting compendiums of the philosophical disciplines, and I recommend it to all. But here's the astonishing thing. He won the top honors in three different fields: for his work in mathematics, for his work in literature, as I mentioned, and for his work in philosophy. I don't think we'll ever see his kind again. Albert Einstein wrote him fan mail. And that pretty much sums up where he stands in terms of public intellectuals.
Now, BGG, as you know, I intend to outlast Alistair Cook, and I mention Alistair in this context because you quote him. "Even from a short distance," said Alistair, "Russell could be fairly mistaken for a beggar. I still recall, of course, that strange voice of his, very shrill."
Yes, yes. Well, I didn't take my first breath of Tasmanian air until 20 days after Lord Russell's ashes were scattered over the Snowdonia Mountains. So I never had the chance to meet him, and all my research was either through his books about him, and in some special cases, radio, audio recordings and television programs. But yes, his voice is quite striking. You know, I think I described it as an exasperated and chain-smoking mother superior with showing enormous restraint. He didn't have a wonderful voice for radio, but by God, when he opened his mouth, people listened.
Some of us remember his visit to Melbourne, where he was at Melbourne University and the subject being discussed was contraception. And Russell had gone through the various categories, you know, this is pre-pill, so he was checking off the condom and the Dutch cap and so on. And a voice in the audience said, "Whistlecock." And the place froze. And he said, "Whistlecock? Yes, whistlecock." And this bloke went on to describe that it was not uncommon amongst Indigenous people in Australia for little holes to be cut in the penis, which would allow any seminal flow to be by, you know, to sort of be spilled upon the ground. And to this day, many of us recall Russell sitting back and in that cackling little laugh, pissing himself at the thought of whistlecock. But I move on. When did you first... Oh, hang on, we've got to mention the fact that he was also very, very taken with the female gender.
Oh, he had an extraordinary weakness for strong and intelligent and slightly mad women.
That's not a weakness, that's a strength, for heaven's sake.
Well, he was then deliciously plagued by this problem throughout his life, and I think of him as a sort of a Tweedy satyr. You know, he was the Warren Beatty of Cambridge, and I recall a story. It might have also been from Alistair Cook that he'd heard of a lady even when Russell was well into his 60s, before his final marriage to the charming Edith Finch, the late Lady Russell, and him making a move on her with these sort of elderly, little bony mittens of his, and it sounded like a rustle of dried leaves making their way up her leg. You know, he was certainly committed to carnal pursuit. He had an appetite for love and life that was really quite intimidating.
I'd like you to tell the listener about how the urination of a koala brought you to Russell's particular writings on idleness.
That's a tenuous and shameful link, but I will yield to you on that. I am, as you know, very passionately committed to the conservation of wildlife and wild places, and royalties from all of my books have gone to this noble endeavor for the last two decades. As part of my responsibilities, I often try to woo potential donors by taking them on private tours of reserves and sanctuaries and occasionally modern conservation zoos. Anyway, my commitment to this endeavor was largely brought about by Russell's work, and particularly this essay in Praise of Idleness, spurring me to take more meaningful action with my life. I had a very successful popular publishing career by that stage. It was a very heavy schedule, some two books a year, often 10 months on the road per year. I was published in 115 countries, which means I have 115 editors under the illusion that I work for them. And so I read Russell's essay in New York after a particularly busy book fair at the Javits Center. And I just thought, I am going to take his advice to heart and pursue more meaningful moments of idleness, active idleness, not passive entertainment. I love the movies. I love music. I love games. I love all sorts of things brought to bear by modern media. But instead of just passively listening or watching, I'm going to do more. So I really committed to these conservation goals. And on one particular occasion, I was taking some wealthy donors around a facility in Australia. And the finale was to get them up and close with a koala. And this jolly koala urinated right in my face. Everyone laughed, thought it was very, very funny. I splashed a bit of water in my eyes and kept going. And the next day I started a book tour, and it wasn't until three or four stops later that my inflamed orbs required very immediate medical attention. I finally got to see an ophthalmologist, and he looks me into my bloodshot eyes and says, "I think you have chlamydia." And I said, "Oh, you know, I wish. You know, I've been reluctantly celibate for some time." And it turns out I contracted it from the koala urine, and a great many of Australia's koalas, particularly on the East Coast, have chlamydia, which can be potentially fatal for them. A very embarrassing situation, a very embarrassing story that my wife loves telling at dinner parties. And I thank you for bringing my great shame to all of Australia.
It's one of my duties here at the Little Wireless Program. So in a way, this brings you to In Praise of Idleness, and which he writes in the early 30s when things were pretty gloomy around the place, weren't they? What with the Great Depression, for example.
No, absolutely. The early 30s, and it was he first wrote the essay. It was published by Harper's Magazine in 1932. But he published then by George Allen Unwin in 35. But it was a very interesting and dark time. And yes, I think you need to look at it in the context of the Great Depression. And that was one of the aspects that made me feel his arguments were especially relevant today. I don't want to draw too many parallels between the recent global economic crisis, but they are definitely there. The central point being in that context that then, as now, we were completely reviewing our attitudes to work, our attitudes towards investment, and how we wish to spend our life based on new technologies and new opportunities. Under the shroud of increasing political and ideological tension. And I think that obviously applies as much to 2015, 2016 as it did to 1932.
Now, the book is divided into four sections: the illusion of wealth, the nature of history, the ethics of work, the importance of happiness. And I have to be jolted back to the reluctant realization that he wasn't a socialist. He called himself a compassionate capitalist.
Yes, and I think it's a more accurate description. I mean, I consider myself to be, I aspire to be a compassionate capitalist, and I'm certainly a capitalist, but I have socialist leanings. And unlike many theoretical socialists, I've gone to investigate this at the source. You know, I've been to Cuba, I've spent quite a bit of time in Russia, and I think I came to the similar conclusions that Russell did, albeit 50 years later, that I think of these ideologies as being like organic fruit, and that in their purest form, there is nothing better for those that partake of them. But they are so desperately prone to corruption, and once bespoiled, they are utterly worthless.
Now, let's look at his view on the redistribution, not of wealth, but of work.
Yes. Well, he's not even remotely a Marxist. He doesn't believe that that one should be rewarded for effort. You know, he very much believes it's your contribution that matters, and you're measured then by what you create for others. But this notion that there's a certain class of person that should do nothing but work, and another class of person, in this case a very wealthy industrialist, or what he's more pointedly referring to as inherited wealth, should sit around and do nothing. He doesn't condemn them utterly. He doesn't demonize the rich, but he acknowledges that their responsibility with those moments of active idleness to dream up the things that make life joyous, all the arts and sciences were born ultimately of idleness, of someone having time to think about something for no other reason than thinking about it was incredibly fulfilling. That is not a responsibility that should just be granted to the rich. All of us should be entitled to do that. But we don't have the opportunity to do that because we're so exhausted just getting through the work week that we have nothing left but to sort of collapse in front of the television or what have you in this and soak in this sort of greasy passive entertainment. And so the world is the great loser in this outcome. So the redistribution of work was the idea of tapping in to an otherwise dormant intellect and dormant creativity inherent in all men and women and deny them by virtue of their economic, socioeconomic status.
He argued that excessive work degrades our minds. I've never worked excessively, so I can't can neither confirm nor deny. But he runs the line that idleness makes people happy, it's essential for playfulness and curiosity, and that happy people are kinder. So you've got a positive cycle.
Yes, a virtuous circle. Mm-hmm. Quite right. And I think that's really at the heart of it. We're sort of be smarter and happier if we give ourselves time to think, time to dream. And I've often said, you know, ultimately we will be judged by our achievements and not by our dreams. But without dreams, we'll achieve nothing. And I think so much of today, and I've mentioned this a number of places, that we're so busy. The digital age has not freed us up.
One of the parts of your hyperactivity is that you give lectures on creativity, and I bet that many of the people you mention Russell to have never heard of him.
That is sadly true and increasingly true, and of those few that have known of his name, haven't read much of his work, and almost none of them have read In Praise of Idleness. And my general view is that if I give a lecture to, say, 100 or 200 or 500 people, regardless, I don't expect to see more than 20 hands know of Russell. And I only see two or three that have claimed to have read In Praise of Idleness, but I've always maintained that at least one proud arm is attached to a diamond-encrusted bullshitter. And were they to be pursued on the essence of this essay, they would be just stammering and fumbling gibs. So, yes.
A 21st century parallel to Bertrand and his celebrity is, of course, Stephen Jay Hawking. And once again, everyone thinks thinks they know what he's on about, but very few have read his best-selling books. This is LNL on RN, and my guest is BTG, Bradley Trevor Grieve, and we're discussing the enduring relevance of one of the great philosophers of the 20th century, the prolific and now, in a sense, vanishing Bertrand Russell. Everyone remembers Einstein, but the impact of Russell is being forgotten. It's interesting that, you know, his early career, you describe his parents, the Viscount and Viscountess Amberley, as the Zelda and Scott Fitzgerald of the Victorian era. That I knew, but I didn't know that his godfather was, for heaven's sake, John Stuart Mill.
Yes, quite right. But it would still be misleading. He came into his inheritance, his intellectual and political and sociological inheritance, late. It would be misleading to think that he was swathed in radical diapers because, of course, everyone who was sort of responsible to care for him seemed to die very, very quickly and very early. Mill died, and Spalding, his tutor and sometime lover of his mother, and in fact, the father of modern genetic research. In fact, one can draw parallels between Richard Dawkins and Spalding, both Darwinian chicken researchers of some renown. So Spalding dies, and he's left with a mustachioed bookbinder, Cobden Sanderson, comes across to me, even though he was the father of the arts and crafts movement, as a bit of a prat, and he's all that's left. So Russell had to, through his love of books, discover who his parents were, discover who his godparents were, through reading. And reading was essential to his his worldview, and certainly it saved his childhood. I remember, and I've actually got a copy here, it doesn't fall apart in my hand, of Fact and Fiction, but there it is. He's talking about the importance of Shelley, his great role model, but he says, "From books I derive courage and hope and freedom in arduous endeavor." So he read his way into his intellectual heritage and was blessed thricefold as a result.
One of the reasons I held him in great personal regard is that he confirmed, not taught, he confirmed some of my own ideas that I'd formulated when I was 5 and 6. You know, I asked myself the question then, if everything has to have a beginning, and the beginning is God, who begun God? Russell asked himself the same question much later, but it was his atheism that I found so exhilarating. And of course, there are many threads to his immense comprehension. One of them comes from, and I didn't know about this, what Russell called fruitful monotony. That's wandering the vast gardens of Pembroke Lodge. It wasn't just books. It was walking around just thinking.
Exactly. And that is the very literal example of his active idleness, taking time away just to think, just to enjoy the pleasure of deep thought and to mull over problems and search for answers for which there is currently no question. And, he did this to us.
I like that, to search for answers where there were currently no questions.
Yes.
Brilliant.
I think he was, genuinely looking to find himself. He wasn't a particularly cheery little boy. His older brother, Frank, was quite a difficult and obstreperous lad. But Bertie, as he was known at that time, was sort of quiet and polite. But this veneer of a young and diminutive British gentleman in training masked a furious passion of intellectual vigor and inquiry. And he kept a secret diary of his many and very interesting, very mature thoughts, which he would mark Greek exercises, and he would write in code using English words spelt with ancient Greek letters. And that is where his true self resided while he was under the tiny iron fist of his grandmother. It's extraordinary double life where he couldn't reveal to the world for fear of ridicule and condemnation from his Scottish Presbyterian grandparents. He couldn't reveal to the world these incredibly revolutionary ideas and his iconoclastic bent.
I vaguely remember, and this may not be accurate, but I vaguely remember being thrilled by one of the things he said, or one of the things I think he said, when he was accused of inconsistency over his attitude to the two world wars. He was anti-war in the First World War. He was all in favour of obliterating Hitler in World War II. And when he was accused of inconsistency, he said, they're different wars. And Russell would change his position on many an issue, wouldn't he, after applying the rigorous test of truth.
Absolutely. And that's something that makes him special as a thinker, is that he was never attached to certainty. And indeed, he saw it as an intellectual vice. The idea of having to find the one profound truth, to him, is indicative of intellectual weakness. And I believe that's what sets him apart from any other great thinker of his age, that he was so happy to know that he didn't know, and he was not about to be bullied into a position just because it was a view conventionally held by leading an admirable figure, that he didn't really give a damn. He couldn't care less. And as a result, he was embraced by a certain intellectual class and absolutely scorned by others. But I remember him responding to criticism of this apparent or supposed fickleness and what would be called flip-flopping in this day and age, and certainly during the American election cycle that I'm currently enduring over here. And that is that he said, no, it's of course I've changed my mind as evidence requires it. You know, what physicist, prior to the 1930s, what physicist would be ashamed to say they had changed their views. This is, you know, referring to the advent of nuclear physics at a whole nother level and having split the atom after Rutherford. How could you not have changed your view? And it's funny how that we somehow assume that consistency, intellectual consistency, equates to intelligence when in actual fact it is the exact opposite.
You've been listening to Bradley Trevor Grieve, AM, born in Hobart, Tasmania. 20 days after Bert's death, BTG has lived thither and yon over the years in Scotland, Wales, England, Honkers, Singapore, and would you believe, completed his education, well, continued his education here at the Royal Military College, Duntroon, and he served as a paratrooper, platoon commander in the Australian Army. A man of parts, BTG, and his essay on Russell accompanied the new publication of Bertrand Russell's essay, In Praise of Idleness, brought out by Nero. And that's it for LNL. Thank you, beloved team, E.P. Garbazario, Stan Corry, Matt O'Neill, Sasha Fegan, Amritha Slee, Lila Schunner. And now it is your obligation to stick around for the bad news. See you next week.